Welcome to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. I'm your host, Dr. Ronald Hoffman, and it's time once again to visit with one of our favorite guests. She's beyond a guest. She is a weekly contributor to the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. She's my colleague, Layla Mutin, a Hoffman Center nutritionist with a master's degree in nutrition. She's also a registered dietitian. And welcome back from Thanksgiving, Layla. How was your Thanksgiving?
Hi, Dr. Hoffman. Oh, my gosh. It was good. It was very, very, very good. Very good.
So you saw...
We ate a lot.
You ate a lot? you saw all the relatives?
Saw the relatives. We had a nice big feast. We had lots of food, inordinate amounts of wine, and we had great, great fun.
Good.
And are you, how about you?
You're sufficiently recovered?
Yes.
Yeah.
Absolutely.
My experience that I recall was mostly about driving. There was a lot of driving. I had to go, in one direction, 40 miles to pick up a 94-year-old to bring her in an entirely different direction. To some other relative's house, and I did a lot of driving. A lot of people on the road, but good company in the car, and radio to listen to. So anyway, we passed the time. So I'm going to start with today on the Q&A. By the way, if you have a question for Intelligent Medicine Podcast, you can send it to radioprogram@AOL.com, radioprogram@AOL.com. State your question, and we will endeavor to answer it. This one is just a comment. It's a comment from Gary, who is a veterinarian. Dr. Hoffman, I really appreciate your radio talk show and podcasts, and I admire your command of the English language. However, I would like to point out to you the pronunciation of the word veterinarian, as I am one, and I notice you leave out a syllable of the word. It's veterinarian. And I got to admit, Gary nailed me because I kind of say veterinarian, like a lot of people do, right?
I say it like that, veterinarian.
Veterinarian. But we know better because if you have to spell the word, you know that it is a veterinarian.
Right.
And he says this in the, I think, most helpful spirit. Thank you for your wonderful enlightenment. You are changing the world. And I thank Gary for that comment. And I have to say, I have a lot of respect for veterinarians. I'm going to be very careful with my pronunciation now, because veterinarians actually are very nutrition conscious. They are, I have a great time with a friend of mine who is a retired veterinarian. I'm going to be very self-conscious now about saying this correctly.
veterinarian. Okay.
Because he and I are on the same wavelength when it comes to the importance of nutrition. And I've always had the theory that we take better care of our animals than we do ourselves. I mean, if you're a horse owner, you're going to be very careful about what you put in that horse, right?
Absolutely.
And when it comes to, smaller animals, dogs and cats, people are very concerned about nutrition. So I just got an email. I'm going to share this with you and our listening audience, Layla, from my veterinarian friend. And he writes to me, "Hi, Ron. I don't think I ever told you that we had a veterinary diet for virtually every common disease in cats and dogs. And I'm going to read the list. Here is the list."
Wow.
And they come with like initial designations. So number one, AD. That's a concentrated caloric diet for the very ill. All right. Good idea, right?
Wow.
Also, check this one out. BD, it's for cognitive dysfunction in dogs or cats. Then there is the CD diet. It's for struvite and oxalic acid bladder and kidney stones. A specific diet.
Wow.
Okay. Then there's the DD, the allergic dermatitis diet. And you can imagine that's got lots of essential fatty acids and zinc probably, right? There's the GD, not to be confused with the common swear word, GD. It's the geriatric diet, okay, for the older animal. Then there is the HD, that's the cardiac diet or the low-sodium diet. There's the ID, that's the intestinal diet for vomiting and diarrhea. There's the JD, not to be confused with the degree that lawyers get. It's the joint diet. There's the KD, the kidney diet. There's the LD, the liver diet. There's the MD, the diabetes diet. There's the PD, the puppy diet. There's the RD, the reducing diet. There's the TD, the anti-plaque tartar diet. I mean, I think that's for dental plaque, right? The animals get the plaque. There's the UD, copper toxicity and severe renal failure diet. And there's the ZD, which is the hypoallergenic diet. And do you know what that consists of, the hypoallergenic diet?
What?
It's hydrolyzed protein. In other words, protein that is allergen-free, recognizing that common foods cause allergy in animals. So can you imagine that? I mean, and it's...
You would go to a doctor. A person will go to a doctor, but that doctor will not ask you, so what are you eating? How is your diet? But
right.
You go to a veterinarian. What are you feeding your dog?
Of course.
That's
totally,
terrific.
It totally makes sense. And actually, there are companies that, I mean, what I just read you is a list of dietary products from companies that make animal food products, Waltham, Purina, and Hill's, which are animal food companies. So, I mean, they're getting behind it. How come, you know, we're not getting behind it in our supermarket nutrition?
This is a wonderful idea to get behind. Absolutely. A wonderful idea to get behind.
So I thought that would impress you. Hey, you know, if it doesn't work out in human nutrition, there's a place for you, Layla, in a veterinarian's office.
Yeah.
I don't know which
that'll be my plan B.
Plan B. Plan B. In case it doesn't work out at the Hoffman Center. All right. Okay. Because at least, you know, animal owners, they care. Next question. You got a question?
I've got a question here.
Okay.
Dr. Hoffman, this comes from Rich. I think his name is Rich. Could you give me your opinion on mesozeaxanthin?
Okay.
I see it advertised, and I wonder if it is a better form of zeaxanthin. I'm an avid listener of your show, Health Talk, for years. Thank you for all of your valuable information. And it is from Rich.
Okay. So the question, you know, we know that zeaxanthin is a very important eye health nutrient.
Yeah.
And it's usually combined with lutein.
Mm-hmm.
So lutein, these are yellowish, orangish pigments that are important for the retina of the eye, and they protect the retina from damage and deterioration. Ultimately, they can have an impact on the condition macular degeneration.
The macula pigment actually is composed of lutein, zeaxanthin, and mesozeaxanthin.
Right.
So, as well, or mesozeaxanthin.
So I'm going to say this, is as with some newer supplements that are being touted as superior. The answer is, I don't yet know the answer on this one. So I'll give you a good analogy. Alpha lipoic acid is an important antioxidant. There are some people who swear that R alpha lipoic acid is the superior form of alpha lipoic acid, and they point to its greater efficacy. It's more expensive, but it's more, shall we say, body ready. I haven't made up my mind on that controversy. That controversy has been going on for years. I think this one about the mesozeaxanthin is of interest, but I just don't know the answer. Some of the research is being done with just plain zeaxanthin. Probably not
That's
a heck
true.
Of a lot of research is being done with just mesozeaxanthin. The word's not in yet. And, you know, sometimes when companies make those claims, it's a way to distinguish themselves from the wider marketplace and to give them sort of a head and shoulders advantage over other competitors who just offer plain old zeaxanthin, which they claim is inferior, which may just, you know, be fine and do the trick.
It's not inferior. If we're taking in lutein, zeaxanthin from our produce, from our egg yolks, all of that, we do have the ability to convert lutein into mesozeaxanthin inside the macula, according to what I'm reading here.
Okay.
But apparently as we get older, we don't do it so well.
Okay.
And I think that's the shtick for that particular.
Okay.
But that's not necessarily true for everyone, I don't think.
And another analogy might be taking regular coenzyme Q10 versus taking ubiquinol. For some people, mm-hmm. coenzyme Q10 is fine. And mm-hmm. for others, they may require ubiquinol in sort of a prepackaged, body-ready form as being more efficacious, more bioavailable, or better value.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that that's probably along those lines. And, you know, we'll look at the research, and, you know, I'm going to just take a pass on a final decision on that particular mm-hmm. question, right?
Okay.
All right, I have one here, Dr. Hoffman, Layla. I seem to recall Dr. Hoffman saying that the 125-hydroxy test was not the test to use to assess appropriate or sufficient vitamin D. In a recent conversation with a physician, he emphasized that the 125 test does measure the active form of vitamin D. My own internist also told me years ago that he ordered only the 125 test, and that if either test shows adequate levels, there's no problem. I thereupon implored him to order the 25-hydroxy test, which came in a bit low, and I am supplementing. So that's a really good question. Maybe you can help our listeners understand the difference.
Yeah.
And I have to say, I see a lot of doctors doing this. I think they're not that well informed about vitamin D, the latest research.
Right.
They'll order a vitamin D test, and it sometimes is, in my opinion, the wrong test.
It is. And, you know, I have to, the biggest question mark here, if they see adequate levels of both, but how would you, because they're somewhat inversely associated, because
yeah.
when we see a low 25-OH vitamin D level, which is the proper test that we use, we see the inverse. We see a much higher level of 125, active form. So how do we reconcile that?
Let's go back to this.
Yeah.
What's the actual physiology? What happens is you take in vitamin D as either D2 or D3. Okay, so D2 is sometimes the prescription form, and D3 is mostly what's available in health food stores. It's what we prescribe. D3 is more bioavailable. That's a different thing than the 25 or the 125, but that's the source, the dietary source of vitamin D. So what happens? Well, the body has to convert vitamin D to its active form. So there's two steps. One step is in the liver, and that's what converts it into 25 hydroxy vitamin D. That's the liver step. The next step is in the kidney. That adds a 1 to the 25, and that becomes 125 hydroxy vitamin D, and then that's body-ready vitamin D. All right? So I can see their argument saying, look, as long as your 125 is okay, that's what counts. It's the body-ready vitamin D, but not so fast, because it turns out that the 25 itself actually has actions in the body that are distinct from the 125. The 125 seems to work mostly on skeletal muscle, and the 25 may have effects in many other areas of physiology. So actually, I'll give you a case where you can have too much or very high 125 and really deficient 25, and that case is Crohn's disease. In Crohn's disease, actually, if you want to diagnose Crohn's disease and you don't know what the patient has, you're not sure whether they have ulcerative colitis or Crohn's disease, a test that's pretty good is a 125 hydroxy vitamin D. It would appear that the person's vitamin D is sky high. But if you check for the 25 that actually is important in controlling the disease, the 25 is often low. So, you know, the 125 is useful in patients who have kidney disease. That's really where the only place where I see that as being important. Because if your kidneys are shot, you can't add the 1 to the 25, and therefore you actually need to get oral medication that's 125 vitamin D. It's called Rocaltrol. That's specifically for kidney patients. That's when your kidneys aren't working, or maybe you're on dialysis, or you have really poor kidney function. Then you need a prescription vitamin D that you can't get at a health food store. And the 125 test is useful, but otherwise, I always use the 25 hydroxy test, and that's how. I mean, you talk to the experts on vitamin D, the top people, that's what they're looking at, and there's no point in looking at 125. And doctors, it's almost like they flip a coin: 125, 25. It's all the same. No, it's not.
Another question I'm frequently asking patients who don't necessarily bring me any previous blood tests from their doctor or their primary care or something. Oh, but no, my vitamin D is like a 55. It's perfectly fine. Well, was it this test or was it this test? Oh, okay. Well, that's why I need to see it myself with my own eyes. That makes all the difference in the world.
But
that's a wonderful explanation of the physiology of vitamin D.
Thanks. I have to say that there's a new wrinkle, and it's going to, you know, I don't know if I can completely explain it to people now, but there's a big study that's out of the New England Journal of Medicine. It's really quite fascinating. We know that a lot of African Americans have low vitamin D. They have low vitamin D. And, you know, according to the criteria for vitamin D adequacy, you know, the majority of them would be found to have suboptimal vitamin D. And what they found is that, and this is where it gets really complicated, because it's not just, you know, the vitamin D that you take or the amount of sunlight that you're exposed to. There are individual and racial differences in your levels of vitamin D. And it turns out that African Americans would appear to have lower scores on their vitamin D when they may actually have comparable vitamin D levels to Caucasians, non-African Americans. And they actually have beautiful research in the New England Journal of Medicine where they actually show that there's a specific carrier gene for vitamin D. And the carrier gene for vitamin D in African Americans, that very high percentage of African Americans have, it holds the vitamin D more strongly and pulls it out of the bloodstream, making it seem like you have a lower score on vitamin D. So what they're going to have to do is they're saying they're going to need new tests to account for this, the genetic differences in vitamin D binding. And, you know, it's really complicated. And so that's why I think this may be why we're seeing some people require enormous amounts of vitamin D. Other people don't need vitamin D. Some people respond to just, you know, 400 or 800 international units. Other people require 10,000. It's complicated.
Yeah.
And we're learning more and more about it.
So it appears that the binding proteins are more or less in that particular genetic polymorphism, if that's indeed what's going on, which is fascinating.
Yeah, so I mean, it's not just you know, there's a lot of factors. You know, if you have dark skin, you won't make as much vitamin D because your skin, you know, actually doesn't. It's protected from the ultraviolet rays, which is appropriate for people who evolved in an equatorial region. It's not appropriate if you live in Detroit, you know, because you're further north and you know you're not going to get enough sun exposure. Then there's the question of how much does your digestive system absorb. Then there's the question of how much does your body bind and how your vitamin D receptors react in the presence of vitamin D. And it gets very complicated. So, you know, it's not just about your absolute level, you know, how much you need.
And there are certain medications that will interfere.
Absolutely.
With the absorption of vitamin D, anticonvulsants, steroid medications. There are many medications that would interfere with that. So taking a look at that is also appropriate. Yeah, but it's all fascinating. And this is, you know, as you were saying some time ago, that this is all emerging science, and we need to pay attention to it, and we need to stay on top of it, and this is what we do.
Yeah.
This is what we need to do.
All right, I have a question from Bob. Bob is a patient of ours. So Bob writes, "Hello, Dr. Hoffman. The protocol I've been on since seeing you starting a little over 5 years ago has been very successful in connection with my prostate problems." Bob, you know, since I'm going to not mention your last name, I can share that Bob has prostate cancer. He has elected not to undergo radiation treatment or prostate surgery, which was a daring choice about 6 or 8 years ago. It's now become an option because there are people who are getting active surveillance where they get frequent biopsies. All his biopsies have subsequently been negative, and he's doing great, and his doctor's becoming less interested in doing biopsies, which is good news. He now writes, "I thought you might be able to suggest some supplements that might help my 59-year-old brother's essential tremors in his left arm, hand, and leg. He's had the tremors for quite a few years, but has just received the official diagnosis from a neurologist. And Bob writes, congratulations on the success of your podcast. I've been listening from the beginning and religiously so. That should reach 100,000 monthly downloads by January if it keeps increasing in listenerships as it has been, and definitely reach your 250,000 goal next year sometime. So thanks, Bob, and thanks for spreading the word. And all of you listening, keep sharing the podcasts with your friends, because we want to put the podcasts over the top of our 250,000 goal in 2014. So, Bob, the question is for essential tremors. Lately, have you found anything that helps our patients with essential tremors?
Essential tremor, glutathione, and did I mention glutathione?
Okay.
Ah, CoQ10. And okay. Did I say CoQ10?
Right.
Ubiquinol, rather. Yeah.
And I also have to say that for some patients, I think they become a little more tremulous when they become hypoglycemic. So, you know, blood sugar stabilization is important. You know, maybe something along a Perlmutter protocol for the brain, you know, more ketones for the brain, less
ketogenic
sugar.
Ketogenic diet, yes.
Yeah.
Yes.
However, that being said, I see modest benefits with, glutathione and coenzyme Q10. It can help. But it's not slam dunk. And what I'm very intrigued by are new reports of brain stimulation that can be done with either an implantable electrode in the brain, which is, you know, sounds very scary, or now they can do it extracranially. There may be a way to do it just with sort of a elaborate apparatus that you place on the, like a skull cap around the head. You know, either you get, you know, treatments from time
an
to
antenna?
Time. Yeah, or maybe a walk around with something in the future. Uh-huh. There'll be something that will stimulate the brain from externally, you know, short of drilling a hole through the skull, which is, you know, is a pathway for infection and complications. So, but I think that they're actually going to be able to nail this. They've actually done some research. I've seen it in major medical journals where it's sort of like what they do for cardiac arrhythmias. They use a zapper kind of therapy. It's called ablation to burn out some of the nerve pathways that are causing the tremor. And if they do it right, they'll get rid of the tremor without weakening the patient or causing the patient to have paralysis. So I think they're really on the cusp of dealing with it. You know, I think it's probably not worth it for patients to have like a little minor, you know, shaking. But if it's very debilitating, as it sounds like in Bob's brother, you know, I suggest that you go to a major medical center and find out if they have a program in treatment for this.
Yeah,
it's just an emerging thing. It's just brand new.
Yeah, this is for tremor that is non-Parkinsonian.
Yeah, exactly. So you know, we're talking. Let's distinguish, because if you have Parkinson's disease, I really think that glutathione and coenzyme Q10 are can help a lot. With essential tremor, it's different. It's, you know, it's often hereditary. The clue with essential tremor is the essential tremor, it's kind of like the gunslingers. You know, you always see them. They go into the saloon before a gunfight. I said, why in the hell would you go to a saloon and get, you know, tipsy or drunk before a gunfight when you need, you know, to have your wits about you? And the answer is that everybody has a tremor. I mean, when you can measure it with a sensitive instrument, even in people who seem to have steady hands. And alcohol suppresses tremor in general. So if they wanted to shoot straighter, they would have a couple of shots of whiskey. And if they could maintain their wits about them, they might do better in a gunfight. But somebody with an essential tremor, you just ask them, well, you know, do you notice if you have a drink that your tremor gets better? And they'll say yes. And that's what they have. And it's hereditary. It actually, you know, is a familial trait.
Fascinating.
Yeah. And I mean, there are guys who I knew in medical school who wanted to be surgeons, and they were very bright and they didn't have any disease, but they just had a tremor. So instead they had to become, endocrinologists or psychiatrists because they had shaky hands and, you know,
they couldn't be surgeons. Yeah.
They washed out of their surgical programs because, right away they could see, you know, you got shaky hands, you know, you can't do it.
Wow.
All right.
Wow.
Okay.
I have a question here.
Yeah.
This comes from Dennis. Dennis writes, what do you and Dr. Hoffman recommend for Epstein-Barr chronic fatigue syndrome?
Okay.
Do you use Valtrex or natural antivirals? And then he has a follow-up question. What do you recommend for mild to moderate intestinal permeability? Oh, this is actually from Jackie. sent from Dennis's email. Okay.
Wow.
Okay.
He's getting a lot of questions in, Dennis. All right.
Yeah.
So, first of all,
what do you recommend
First of all, I don't really believe in Epstein-Barr. You know,
everyone has it.
It sounds controversial. It's like, you know, do you believe in Santa Claus? I don't believe in Epstein-Barr virus as the cause of chronic fatigue syndrome or chronic viral syndrome. It's very hard to pinpoint that as the cause because people come in feeling very viral and sick, and they're sick, they're dizzy, sometimes they have swollen glands. And they've had it for a long time. And this may be a chronic Epstein-Barr. It was fashionable to call it that in the 1980s. But since then, we've recognized that whenever you have any kind of virus or any kind of infection, those titers go up in your bloodstream. And so meaningless, really meaningless. I mean, a lot of people who are...
Does that explain why anybody who's coming in with those kind of blood tests are always showing a positive for Epstein-Barr?
You know, I think it's sort of a sleight of hand that some doctors use, because when they can't figure out what's going on with the person's sick and debilitated, they'll run an Epstein-Barr test, and the test will be positive. They'll go, aha, you have Epstein-Barr. And then people say, oh, okay, thank you very much for the diagnosis. You're a genius. You figured out what I have. What can I do about it? And the doctor says, well, we have no treatment for it. Come back in, 5 or 10 or 15 years when we have a treatment for it. So it's tempting to think that we can use antiviral medication. After all, we managed to, in a very short period of time, take a devastating fatal disease, AIDS, and virtually cure it. It's not necessarily curable, but you can control it through the use of a combination of antiviral drugs. So why can't we cure chronic fatigue syndrome or Epstein-Barr with antiviral medications? Well, for some reason, it just doesn't work. And I've talked to...
Same way we can't cure the common cold, which is also a virus.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, if indeed we could put a dent into it, the drugs would be, A, much too expensive, and B, the side effects would be devastating. Overkill... with all kinds of neurological problems, kidney problems, liver problems, very, very potentially devastating side effects. I mean, maybe warranted to have certain side effects if you're going to be suffering from a potentially fatal disease like AIDS, but not for a viral infection. There are some people doing trials of, some of the drugs that are used to treat herpes outbreaks, Valtrex, for example, that he mentioned.
Yes.
In my opinion, it doesn't really work. I know that there are some doctors who throw that at patients who have what seem to be viral syndromes. I've done it on a couple of occasions. It hasn't been that successful. So we're looking for that ideal antiviral medication that'll help people like this. But A, we don't even know what the viral target is. They actually, very hopefully, a couple of years ago, they thought they came up with the virus that was the causative virus for chronic fatigue syndrome. There was a big hoopla, and they announced that they had discovered the virus and that they were going to be able to then come up, once you discover a virus, you can test it and you can see what medication kills it. What they discovered was that it was at best a mistake and at worst an instance of scientific fraud. So the doctors who actually promoted this really got in trouble. They were discredited. They were, they had to withdraw their initial papers from medical journals, which is a big deal. They basically said that, it wasn't valid.
Yeah. Wow. Well, I think the best remedy for any antiviral, or if you're coming down with a lot of colds or infection or anything like that, I love our vitamin C drips. I love our immune protocol.
Yeah, the immune protocol might be very helpful. It's got a lot of the natural things that help immunity, including it has some of the minerals that are very important, zinc, selenium, and so on.
Other vitamin C, transfer factor. Things of that nature. AHCC is also helpful for immunity.
Empower goes into the Empower.
Yeah,
by the way,
Empower.
For our listeners who don't know where to find some of these ingredients, drhoffman.com is our website, and we've got a store. And it's a good way to subsidize, in effect, these free podcasts. Lots of information that we're giving out here, but we also have to support our ongoing enterprise at the Hoffman Center. So check out our supplements at drhoffman.com. That was a brief commercial message, and I support this message.
Getting back to immune system, it's also very, very important to clean up the diet. If you want to feel well, you can't be having a cookie every day after lunch or dessert every evening after dinner. All that sugar is shown to suppress the immune system. So it's very, very important to get enough sleep as well. Not getting enough sleep will suppress immunity as well. Stress will suppress immunity. Take care of those things as well.
Yeah.
And take your supplements.
And I also like to use something called low-dose naltrexone for patients with a chronic fatigue syndrome or what seems to be a chronic viral syndrome. It is helpful in some instances at turning it around. We have some patients who came to us with chronic fatigue syndrome, and now they're fine. And many of them ascribe it to the low-dose naltrexone that I prescribe for them.
Yeah.
So a second part of the question.
Yeah, the second part of the question, Jackie asks, what do you recommend for mild to moderate intestinal permeability? First, let's talk about what intestinal permeability is, also known as leaky gut. Many things can cause it. Eating your food, allergenic foods, if there are certain foods you're allergic to and you continue to eat them, that can cause a leaky gut. The use of alcohol, unfortunately, can cause a leaky gut. NSAIDs, non-steroidal anti-inflammatory drugs, your aspirin, your Tylenol, your Motrin, all of those things may cause intestinal permeability. A bad lifestyle, smoking, a really crappy diet, all of these things can cause a leaky gut.
Food allergy,
and
too.
Food allergy, yes, yeah. Food allergy.
Or
so taking care of all those things.
A yeast problem,
A yeast problem can cause a yeast.
Bad bacteria in your intestines, the so-called small intestinal bacterial overgrowth or SIBO, disrupts the lining of the intestine, thus causing it to be leaking. So what's actually leaking? Some people go, my goodness, I'm leaking.
Happens is the tight junctions in the intestinal tract have been loosened up. Gaps are forming. So you're getting not completely digested food particles that are actually coming through and causing, the immune system to stir up, to kick up. And that's what's happening there. It can cause a whole lot of other symptoms. It could cause joint pain. It could cause swelling, any other immune flares. It can even trigger autoimmunity. We see all of that starting with a leaky gut, any trigger of autoimmune conditions. So the first thing to do is to take care and to repair, to remove any bacteria, overgrowth of candida, small bacterial overgrowth. Get rid of all of that. You want to re-inoculate the gut with healthy bacteria. And it's also important to include a very important amino acid to help repair the lining of the gut, the epithelium, and that's L-glutamine.
Yes, it really does work.
Very important.
And, I'm favoring that less for ulcerative colitis and Crohn's disease, but for patients who have leaky gut syndrome where they have lots of food allergies and they may have, malaise and they just have unexplained illness, and we do the leaky gut test. It's easy to do. And if we find increased intestinal permeability, those are some of the things we do, and we administer L-glutamine as well.
Yeah. L-glutamine is popular. It's used in the hospitals.
Yes.
In critically ill patients as well.
It's actually used sometimes to offset the negative side effects of chemotherapy. It will actually reduce peripheral neuropathy with some types of chemo, which cause peripheral neuropathy or numbness and tingling pain in the hands and feet.
Mm.
So it's actually a chemo drug. Interesting. Okay. I have one. I think we have time for one more. And that is from, can't tell the name of this person. Dr. Hoffman, my 24-year-old son just had viral pericarditis, actually myocarditis. After being hospitalized, he was released and has been taking lisinopril and colchicine for 2 months. What supplements would you recommend for healing his heart muscle that had a focal myocarditis of his left ventricle? So let's talk about what this is. Myocarditis is an inflammation of the heart muscle. It's very, very serious. It's one of the most serious kinds of infections you can get, because if you have an infection in your sinuses, that's bad. If you have an infection in your prostate, that's uncomfortable. But if you have an infection in your heart, you can literally die. You can require a heart transplant because your heart muscle gets killed And it's very serious. And this is a 24-year-old kid, so you don't usually see 24-year-olds with severe heart problems. But this could actually result in the need for a heart transplant. It can take a 24-year-old and make them weak as a kitten, and they can barely cross a room without being short of breath. So it's a very, very serious problem.
Dr. Hoffman, what's scary about this is that it's viral.
Yes, it's viral. Right. So there is no, and once again, you know, we think, well, you know, just use a medication. Well, there's no clear-cut antiviral strategy for this. You know, we tend to think that we're in the era of find a bug, use a drug. Well, there's no drug that's going to get rid of this. Now, there's an interesting thing about myocarditis. There was an epidemic of severe viral myocarditis in China. In the 1970s or 1980s. And, you know, say what you like about the Chinese. When they want to solve a problem, they really mobilize. So what they were discovering is that a lot of people were getting, fatal myocarditis, or they were developing congestive heart failure because of damaged heart muscle. And it was in a province called Keshan, K-E-S-H-A-N. And what they discovered was very interesting, and I got to give them a lot of credit. They investigated, they sent teams of scientists into Keshan province, and they tried to find out, you know, what is it? Are people getting poisoned? Is there some sort of toxin? What is going on that this is only happening in this province of Keshan? And they met with agricultural scientists, and they analyzed the soil. And they looked at the plants, and what they discovered is that there was virtually no selenium in the plants in Keshan province, and that the people of Keshan province had major selenium deficiencies. So this being China, you know, you want to get things done, you know, don't try to do it in a democracy. Do it in a people's republic. So they made everyone in Keshan province take selenium supplements. And they actually, I think they put selenium into the fertilizer. They just add a little bit of selenium to the fertilizer. It went, you know, it came up through the plants. And what happened was no more Keshan's syndrome, no more myocarditis. They cured the disease with a nutrient. So it's actually a resounding triumph for nutritional medicine from, of all places, China. And so, you know, it may be shutting the barn door after the horse gets out, but I would check this 24-year-old for selenium. I would also give him selenium. It's an immune enhancer. And of course, I mean, this is a no-brainer. You got to use coenzyme Q10 or ubiquinol at very high doses to help the heart muscle.
Yeah, that magnesium, D-ribose, all of those things.
Carnitine.
Cleaner diet, carnitine, yes. Wow.
And I might even suggest that this kid get intravenous glutathione, because it could be good for, you know, helping to heal and revive, because, you know, glutathione is a partner with selenium in promoting immunity. And so I could see it as being part of a cleanup strategy for myocarditis.
Yeah.
I mean, I don't know where they're calling from, but I just wish this kid were a patient of mine, because I feel for him. He's 24. It's a very serious problem. And we want him to recover fully without without heart damage. But, you know, all the heart cardiac nutrients, I would use high doses of coenzyme Q10, maybe 1,600, add some ubiquinol, maybe an additional 400 of ubiquinol, just to, you know, to flood the heart with coenzyme Q10, which is the most beneficial thing for the heart energy production. That would be the key.
CoQ10 is concentrated in the heart muscle, yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. Best of luck.
Yeah, that's a tough problem. All right, I think that is all we have time for today. Once again, I want to thank you very much for joining us and for helping me to field questions.
Thank you so much for the opportunity.
Sure, my pleasure. It's always my pleasure to co-host with you. And radio program at AOL.com is the place you can send your questions. A reminder, you can friend me on Facebook, and you can follow me on Twitter. My Twitter handle is at Dr. Ronald Hoffman. And if you want to subscribe to our great newsletter, which Layla contributes to every week, it's radioprogram@AOL.com. Just state that you want a newsletter subscription. Check out our Hoffman Center store for products. And that's all she wrote for today's edition of the Intelligent Medicine Podcast. Thanks for joining us.